From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, J.J. Green, national security correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA, and our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Democratic members of the U.S. House of Representatives delivered articles of impeachment to the Senate, paving the way for the trial of Donald Trump, the president of the United States. Meanwhile, an associate of Trump's personal lawyer says the president was aware of a campaign to pressure the Ukrainian government to carry out investigations that would help Trump politically, and a report was released by a nonpartisan government agency that concluded that the Trump administration broke the law by withholding aid to Ukraine. The United States and China have signed phase one of a trade deal that may help lower tensions between the world's two largest economies. Days of protests appear to indicate public anger has been redirected away from America's targeted killing of a top Iranian general and has now focused on Iranian leaders over the accidental downing of a Ukrainian airliner. And Democratic presidential candidates met for a critical debate Tuesday in Iowa, less than 3 weeks before Iowa voters kick off the presidential nomination process on February 3rd. We assess the debate and set the table for the upcoming Iowa caucuses. Panelists, welcome. Let's start, of course, with the impeachment of Donald Trump, which has gone from the theoretical to the real. Well, this is actually happening. We've been talking about it, a process that began almost amazingly with a whistleblower report about a phone call that seemed improper between the Ukrainian president and the U.S. president. And now we've come to this, the trial for removal of a U.S. president from office. This landscape has changed dramatically, I believe, in the last 48 hours after the articles of impeachment being delivered with great ceremony, great seriousness, which I actually was quite happy to see. You have associates, some say henchmen of the president, who is naming top names in the government as being absolutely complicit in the loop on every detail of the plot to discredit former vice president and current presidential candidate Joe Biden. You also have this report from the Government Accountability Office, a nonpartisan group within the government that has said that the president's administration broke the law. The Office of Management and Budget, which is in the administration, broke the law when it held back aid for political reasons. And their quote was, "Faithful execution of the law does not permit the president to substitute his own policy priorities for those that Congress has enacted into law." Got to start with you, JJ. The ceremony again is passed. We're in it for real now. This trial, when did the actual trial start to happen? When do we start hearing arguments and that sort of thing? Or is there still more process to go?
It's my understanding it's supposed to start on Tuesday. When it starts, the flame is not going to be a low flame. It's not going to be a gradual buildup. It's just going to be fireworks based on what they're facing. And the people I've been speaking to, it's just going to start full bore from the very beginning. And a part of the reason for that is what you just said was were these latest developments in this long backstory about all this that's taken place. Then there are these new developments that have sort of been dropped into the fire, and these are serious propellants, including one of which is the Ukrainian Internal Affairs Ministry saying, okay, we're going to investigate what you, the Congress, told us in your documents that you released, that Marie Yovanovitch, the ambassador to Ukraine, was actually illegally monitored in our country. And one of the things that's come out of that is, why isn't the U.S. investigating this? Why isn't the State Department or Secretary of State Mike Pompeo saying anything about this? And again, these associates you're talking about, this henchman Lev Parnas, who supposedly, and that's just a quote in quotations, says all these people are involved in this. Is he telling the truth? Who was involved and who wasn't? And all of this, I think, is important to establish right off the bat. And you can't do it without witnesses. So this is the thing that I think is going to have to be dealt with. That's why I think the fireworks start immediately.
Kimberly, your take.
You know, I was just listening to you talking just now, JJ, and it's like, oh my gosh, there have been so many names, so many people, like, and so many, this cast of characters just keeps expanding. Lev Parnas, an associate of Rudolph Giuliani, the lawyer of the president, and he's out here on cable news, talking to newspapers, saying, you know, as he's negotiating his deal in his own trial, that President Trump knew what he and other associates were doing, that Mike Pence, the vice president, who's pretty much been out out of this for most of this debate that he knew that Attorney General Barr, who heads up the legal division here in the U.S. of the Trump administration, that he knew. I mean, naming names and providing receipts, documents, text messages, napkins with scribbles on them. And in this waterfall of events leading up to impeachment, just when you think it can't get any more dramatic, just another tranche of things comes through. But at the same time, you have the Republicans who control the Senate, still kind of digging in their heels. I mean, remember Mitch McConnell said he was in lockstep with the Trump administration. Working with them on the process. But, yesterday they had to swear and sign their names in an oath book before the Chief Justice of our Supreme Court here that they were going to be impartial jurors, and they have to sit there. And, you know, for people who don't pay much attention to the U.S. Senate, very rarely do you have all of the senators sitting in the chamber at one time. The little close shot shows a lectern, but all of the senators have to sit there in silence.
In silence, without their phones, no electronics.
No electronics, mm-hmm. And be a jury.
Yeah, I would say it's a sight that our government is still working somehow. You know, we can always say that the wheels may be a little bit loose and wonky, and maybe there's a couple of rusty pipes, but it seems as though the process of government is working. This is a place where people are held accountable in the will of the Senate in a situation like this, and in a procedure like this. JJ, Kimberly was talking about the Republican senators and how they're digging in their heels. You have all this information coming forward, even without this. There were certain Republican senators, some who are in quote-unquote swing states where they have to consider both sides of the political aisle, some that are not running for office again, who are being thought of as possible votes for having witnesses. If there are no witnesses, can there be a fair trial? Is it possible to have something like that?
I don't see how you can have a trial without witnesses, fair or not. I mean, and certainly, you know, I don't think it can be fair for either side if you don't have witnesses.
Well, should there be witnesses on both sides? Should Hunter Biden, Joe Biden, would that be fair game for witnesses?
You know, I understand that there's been some discussion about just opening it up and saying, hey, let's do this. Let's have those people in there, Hunter Biden, Joe Biden, all of these people in there, along with the other people that the Democrats want to have. But there's this reluctance to do this because of, one, I think it's the administration wants to do this quickly. And I think there are senators who are complaining about how long it's going to take them away from their business outside of the halls of Congress. As Kimberly mentioned, it's really hard to get them all there at one time. But I don't think so.
Especially the senators who are running for president.
Yeah, and they're four,
like,
at least.
The campaign trail.
I don't think you can have a fair trial. And so is it fair to who? Fair to the public. That's a key consideration here. That's why all of this is taking place, because of the responsibility of that body to the public, to the people in this country. So it's no, I don't think that can happen without witnesses.
Kimberly, what's been the president's reaction so far?
His reaction to this whole thing is always fake news. It's a witch hunt. It's not real.
Hoax.
It's a hoax. These latest developments with the associate of Rudy Giuliani, Lev Parnas, that he didn't really know the guy. And, you know, Lev Parnas is putting out all these photos of him with Trump and trying to provide evidence that the president knew. And the president is just saying, oh, I didn't know him. You know, this very famous meme on the internet of Mariah Carey kind of tossing her hair and saying, I don't know her. And this is the presidential version of that. No matter how much evidence comes that the president knew what was happening or was directly engaged, he's constantly responding. And his advocates are saying, as well, and if you pay attention to Fox News, this is what they'll say as well. This is just all a hoax. It's all the Democrats trying to go after him. And meanwhile, the president is actually kind of notching off some accomplishments. He's signing trade deals. He's, you know, touting the good economy and the record stock market and going on campaign rallies. People love him in his base areas. And, you know, he's just moving on with his life, because one thing that has been consistent through this whole thing, in addition to his narrative that it's all fake, is his poll numbers among his Republican base.
Among his base, he is solid. Now, we say this isn't a solid base. It's a calcified base. It's not coming off. Okay? This is something that's permanent for a certain select group. And it's always been the question, is that enough to win? Can he slip through that sort of electoral mail slot that he did in the last election cycle and pull off a electoral college win? I'll let you have the last word on this one, JJ. The impartiality is a thing. Having witnesses is a thing. The timing of this is also a thing, because you had Nancy Pelosi delaying this up until this point. The Republican Republicans certainly want to get through this as fast as possible. Do you believe it's the case that the longer this lasts, the worse it is for the president, or does it really matter?
Well, it's always, in my experience, when it comes to court and trial proceedings, the longer it goes, the worse it gets, because there are more opportunities for more developments to take place. As you've noted, if this had been passed over from the House to the Senate weeks ago, most of this probably would never have come up. But, you know, whenever you're dealing with a situation like this, there's the possibility for unexpected developments. And the thing that I want to just quickly point out about this is that there's a high level of unpredictability about all of this. People cut deals when they're in trouble. Parnas is trying to work on one. There are other people that are connected to him, and people that are connected to them, and people that are connected to them, and things that we don't know. The longer this goes, the more uncomfortable those people get, and the more likelihood that we're going to see more surprises. So I think we should buckle up for this one.
I said last word for you, JJ, but I'm going to give you absolutely the last word.
Well, you know, you're talking about people's shifting alliances and deals, and we heard this week that Michael Flynn, who was caught up in all of the Mueller investigation, if we can even think so far back to that, mm-hmm. he retracted his guilt. He's trying to retract his guilty plea in his own drama, you know, and who knows if that's going to yield something different. But yes, alliances and deals are being made and shifted and retracted, and yeah, buckle up, everybody.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace. J.J. Green, national security correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. And our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back. President Trump and Chinese officials took a crucial step toward resolving the nearly two-year trade war between the world's largest economies by signing a long-sought preliminary trade deal. Now, emphasize preliminary. The so-called Phase One trade deal covers almost every corner of the U.S. and Chinese complicated trading relationship. Agricultural imports, dairy quality standards, financial market access, intellectual property, some of the real touchstones of the whole trade dispute over the last period of time. Trump administration has billed this as a massive victory for the president and vindication for the trade war in the first place and the tariffs and the whole thing. The Chinese are essentially doing the same. Kimberly, this is in your wheelhouse. Is this, in fact, is it a win-win? Is it a win for one side? Or is it kind of sort of like an exhibition game where the results really don't matter? We really haven't started the regular season.
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, it is a deal. It is something where both parties can say, okay, we are at least going to stop escalating this. We are going to hit pause. We are going to have something that you can take home and say it's a win, and I can take home and say it's a win. And it could, in the long term, be a greater win. So what did we get? Mainly things that China is going to do, not so much what the U.S. is going to do. The U.S. is basically not going to implement more tariffs, and they're rolling back some of them. About two-thirds of the existing tariffs that have been thrown at China in this trade war, totaling about $370 billion worth of Chinese imports, are still going to be under tariffs, and the President Trump says he needs that as his negotiating card. The other win for President Trump is that the Chinese are supposed to buy about $200 billion worth of additional U.S. products, mainly in the agriculture sector, which has been one of the areas, even though it hasn't faced as much pain as the manufacturing sector, it's been one of the more public ways that people have really seen the harm in Trump's areas of support.
Right. This is his base.
This is his base in rural agriculture areas. They've really felt the pinch of this. Now, granted, they've also received unprecedented cash bailouts to try to keep some of these farms afloat. But the Chinese gave this caveat that it depends on sort of market needs. Now, if you look at these numbers on the agricultural purchases they're promising over the next 2 years, they're unprecedented. Like, China's never spent this much on our agricultural products. So it remains to be seen. Intellectual property, you know, you have some business groups saying, you know what, good, we're taking some steps, we're moving forward. But again, the devil's in the details. There's this dispute resolution where if a company thinks that their intellectual property rights are being violated or China's violating some part of this deal, they basically have to go to the U.S. and say, hey, fight for us on this. Well, do you really want to be the company that's in China, trying to make money in China, and going and telling on the Chinese officials that you have to work with every day? It remains to be seen.
So there's a lot to be done here. Phase one, and I guess my instinct is to ask, phase one of how many is this phase one of 10? And I'll come back to you with that question because I wanted to get a perspective from JJ and your worldview. JJ, is the world a safer place because the U.S. and China have entered into this deal?
Well, if you can keep the money flowing into your national security programs, as this deal potentially does for both countries, yes. Because when you start to have problems, you know, with your ships and your planes and things break and you can't fix them and you can't pay for them to be fixed, then you have problems. But on a larger scale, the U.S. is no safer than it was when all this started. And honestly speaking, I think we're at halftime. As you said, mm-hmm. there may be 1 to 10 phases or whatever. So right now, we're okay. But, you know, these other phases that have to take place, are they going to happen? Are they real? Is the stuff that's in there that we've been seeing real? And will it matter? A good example of what I'm talking about is go to the grocery store at least 3-4 months ago. You'd go to a grocery store in the southern part of the country, and you wanted to go buy some fish from one of these large grocery chains. And if you pulled it out of the freezer and looked at it, the label said made in China. And the question that a lot of people, Americans, had is, we have fish here. We have people who are fishermen here.
Right.
So why is
why
it
are
necessary?
We doing that?
Right. And so it's because companies wanted that money. But at the same time, does that do anything for our U.S. national security, giving away that part of our economy? And do people actually see any benefit for it? And at the end of the day, aside from those people who are part of that calcified base, I don't know that any other people really see this as a win-win. So maybe they'll ask questions about this one day. Maybe they're all trying to run out the clock, certainly the Chinese, because they recognize this president may be a one-term president.
You raise so many interesting points. So you're talking about the national security thing. China, this week we found out, had its slowest economic growth in 30 years. So
Wow. They
had an incentive to stop the bleeding because their economy was starting to feel it. And you were talking about getting fish, you know, that was said made in China on it. I was doing some research on this actually this week, and to see how businesses have moved their supply chains as a result of the trade war. And so you did have quite a few businesses. There was something like, trying to remember the number, I want to say it was almost a 30% drop in businesses routing their supply chains through China, trying to avoid these tariffs. But where did that business go? It didn't come back to the United States. It went to Vietnam and to India and to Chile and Argentina and Brazil or Mexico. The Europeans, trying to avoid U.S. tariffs, started doing more of their manufacturing in the Middle East and North Africa, what they call nearshoring, not in your own country because it's still too expensive, but bringing it closer to home. And so what this trade war has done is, yes, it shifted global supply chains. It made a lot of manufacturers in particular recognize that they were far too dependent on China, but it didn't bring the work back here.
I think the operative word that she threw in there, and you know, that's been the standard thing, is the word war, because that's really what it is. And when it comes to national security, war is a dirty word. But that's really what this is about. It's destabilized the norms and things that we expect and have grown to expect when we think about a stable country, and not just for here, but for many other countries around the world. And we don't know if we can get that back in the near term.
You know, it's an accepted doctrine that you don't shoot at your trade partners. And it does stand the entire world in a safer place when we have these two great powers not using any sort of term that has the word war in it. in it, in terms of how you phrase it. Let's move very quickly to the Iran protests. In an extraordinary turn of events, the protests that were initially begun to protest the killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani have evolved into protests calling for democratic reforms and for Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, to step down. JJ, this, to me, a possible stunning victory, in a way, for the president. Do you think anybody saw this coming? Is there anybody sort of taking credit for this and saying, we meant to do this? This is what was supposed to happen.
No. The thing about killing General Qasem Soleimani is that there were opportunities to do that going back more than a decade. The prudence and the reason to do it just did not outweigh the risk and the challenges for others who have this opportunity, because they remember, or either they've been told about what took place in 1979 and all of the things that, one, led up to it, and then the things that took place after it. And then there are all the tentacles of Iran, like Hezbollah, Hamas, all of the other organizations that I can't name right here for time purposes and explain, but they recognized that this is not just an organization or a country or a leadership or a group of people that are just fundamentally different from the U.S., but these are people who actually have a plan in place and a program of operation that does not include relating to the U.S., because they disagree and do not like what the U.S. has done and is doing in relationship to their country. The U.S., to go into this saying this is what we intended to destabilize, no, that's not what happened. What I think happened is Secretary of State Mike Pompeo did not like Qasem Soleimani, and this goes back for a long time.
And there seemed to be a personal aspect to that.
A personal aspect to that. And this is what triggered all this. That's really what this was about.
What was interesting to me about these Iran protests is how quickly they shifted. People turned on a dime because there were pre-existing protests in Iran before our recent military escalation. It reminded people, because it wasn't just that the Iranian government accidentally shot down this plane and killed those poor people, but they lied about it. Mm. And the fact that they lied about it for 3 days to their own people infuriated the Iranians, who previously were all gung-ho, America's the worst, you know, we support you. It reminded them why they had been out in the streets months prior. And that was just another moment that shows the nuance and the complications. People have multiple interests. They can sit in the same place.
Yeah, and I think you both have pointed to it, this thing that's sort of the simultaneous thing going on, where we still don't know if we've seen the real Iranian response to the killing of General Soleimani. I think not. And then you have these protests, and who knows where that's going to go. So you usually have these sort of confluence of issues and circumstances.
And it's worth noting that the U.S. sanctions on Iran are decimating the economy. And apparently European Union countries have been getting pressure to even make it harder on Iran. And that's why Iran is sort of steadily moving forward and sort of rolling back its commitments in the Iran deal, because the nuclear deal, because they're saying, look, not only is the U.S. violating its terms, but now it's pressuring European countries to violate their terms of the deal as well. And this whole thing is just getting worse.
Now, we just want to take the last few minutes to talk about the final debate in Iowa before the Iowa caucuses. Just very quickly, we only have a couple of minutes left. I'll start with you, Kim. Sort of winners and losers from that one.
The losers are the Democrats overall, for sure, because we're heading into the Iowa caucuses without a clear front runner. You know, you've got kind of this four-way tie between Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Pete Buttigieg, and Amy Klobuchar just trying her level best to stay in there. She got in some of the, you know, best hits of the night, but she can't seem to really break those polling numbers. Elizabeth Warren did well kind of fighting this electability thing that's been chasing her around. She talked about how the women on the stage were the only ones who'd won every election they've been in versus the men losing.
It was a very interesting 10, that was a moment.
But at the same time, people like Joe Biden, for example, he didn't have to do anything. He just needs to stay in his lead. So by the fact that he wasn't targeted, he, I guess, would be the winner.
What was the main story that came out of that? That was he said, she said, and then there was the audio of what he said to her.
And by that, we're talking about Elizabeth Warren.
And Bernie Sanders. And that was the main story. So the loser in this thing was the U.S. and the American people. The winner was Russia, because that's precisely what they wanted us to be doing at this stage in the game. And that is talking about ridiculous things like that, as opposed to the substantive issues, and putting ourselves in a situation where the country can coalesce and deal with them as the threat that they are. So Russia is the winner and the U.S. is as the loser with that debate.
Yeah, I thought that the loser also was the audience because of sort of the homogeneity of that group. That was a very small and very particular type of group. I have heard, and I think most voters missed the presence of people like Andrew Yang and Cory mm-hmm. Booker, even Kamala Harris, who's been out of the race for a little while now. The field is shrinking, but not necessarily sure if it's improving. That's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and J.J. Green, national security correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. This program is produced by VOA's Kim Lewis. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.